we honor the samskaras. Samskaras are rites of passages. Rites of passages are very important in having a sense of community or a healthy society. As a matter of fact, one of the major problems that society is experiencing these days is that things are happening based on what is called situational ethics, which means that people simply do whatever seems to be functional for the moment. And so that is most unfortunate, because in most cases what is available for the moment is just a certain aggregation of sense gratification, things to stimulate just the desires for eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Things that have very little to do with gaining the deeper understanding about the human condition, about the cosmos. So, society is becoming more and more mechanized in such a way that people are even losing the appreciations of love. We discussed, you know, on the radio the other day, people are losing the understanding of community. They're replacing commodities with communities. So there's a general tendency of thinking that success is the more mature things you can aggregate and play with, have around to, you know, to manipulate. And later, of course, become a slave of. Just the other day, we were at our farm project in Yudhanagri. We have about 400 acres of land. We're looking at different ways of how to engage and building and expanding. So we were busy with, you know, certain builders, just trying to see what they could offer. And one of the things we noticed is some of the houses, because we would look at the plans and then look at some examples of models that they had. And so sometimes we were kind of shocked to see some of the contractors who could build very beautiful homes, but then so much of the home was taken away by these huge, huge garages, two and three car garages. So we're thinking how people have become so much into a modernity that they spend their whole life trying to gain money or arrange for their dream home. And then part of that is just having a big bed or a big room for their car. So much beautiful houses, so much space is just taken up. So we were looking at plans, we were considering how those rooms, that room could be used, and we build a garage outside, or we build another shelter for the car or something else. But basically you see that, and you see how people even worship their cars. They get up early in the morning and they do what's called abhishek, or they wash the car, they bathe the car, they sing to the car. They're looking out the window sometimes during the day, see how the car is doing. They have pictures. They have pictures, you know, their cars, they keep in their wallets, they put it on the office. You know, it's quite amazing. Sometimes you notice with the car and the computer and things that people are spending more time with these things than with their children, with their wife, with their husband. So this is most unfortunate. And one of the reasons is because of a lack of culture. And the major aspect of lack of culture is a lack of understanding accountability. And for it's a lack of also community, being able to hold people responsible for certain experiences in their lives, and a lack of people being able to share certain important life changes, life stage developments with that individual who's undergoing them. And so there's about 16 or so different samskaras, or different distinct times in one's life where the individual is to realize that something is happening very significant, that something is taking place where they are to be sensitive to evaluating that and knowing how to move with those changes in a way that will be healthy for the individual as well as for the society and for the community. Now we do most important things in our life, and we do them sometimes alone. People enter into, you know, into matrimony without much support other than people coming for the wedding, coming for the reception, and that's all. Very little counseling, very little guidance, very little is there instructions given about what the person is going to expect. how to move through those things. And most unfortunate, very few good examples of what a healthy family life entails. And so, in the experiences of Krishna consciousness, there is so much emphasis on these things. There is rituals that are performed when one is thinking of bringing forth child into the world. So rituals performed before husband and wife, man and woman come together for sex life. There's rituals that are performed upon birth ceremony. There's rituals performed the first taking of grain. There's rituals performed the first cutting of the hair, first day going to school, and so many others, all the way up from marriage to marriage, and even up to death. And the idea is how to, one, do things so that we maximize our spiritual, or addressing our spiritual quality, how we minimize some of the complexities and stagnations that are there with the bombardment of sense gratification culture, personalistic culture, manipulative and exploitive. And how even though we are not in the highest consciousness or not in our original position as being Satchidananda Vigraha, full of the knowledge, the bliss, and eternality, as we are out of the material prisons, but while we're in these environments, what to do to allow us to connect more and more with the culture of the spiritual world. And so, engaging in some scholars that are not karmakandic, or not just for trying to enjoy material energy, but engage in activities to minimize the complexities of material energy to access spiritual consciousness. These kind of rituals or rites of passages are very uplifting, invigorating, and raise individual as well as collective consciousness. So Rohini and Daruka have had another child. We had some time ago, of course, we had naming ceremony at Giranagi, as a matter of fact, the community, our farm community, where we gave the name and the very elaborate rituals. Especially for a name ceremony is one of the more important ones, because the child is now getting a label, name that he or she will be hearing for the rest of their lives. And with that name, concomitant with the name is an appreciation that this child is to be a servant of God in a certain way, and an appreciation that the child has come into the world, particularly in the spiritual family, so the child can finish up what they have not completed in the previous life, and so that the parents can give full protection and guidance and help to see that an environment is conducive for the spiritual evolvement of the child. And this brings the opportunity for the husband and wife to complement each other in such a way, be able to do that, and a time for them to literally to learn from the child as they try to be the proper examples. And now we have Ms. Drupadi, or Draupadi, who is, now they have a little girl. How many months? About 7 months?
Almost
7 months. So up to now, she's only been having nourishment from the breast milk, from milk. And so when such and so in the spiritual culture, everything is done or designed in such a way to come closer to God, to bring more blessings, and even to arrange for divine intervention. So therefore, important changes are done with blessings. So normally we think eating is just something that we just do, you know, spontaneous. But at some point we all, you know, started taking solid food. But for spiritualists, the first grains, the first solid food that we take that as food that has been blessed, prasadam, that is also given by the priestly class. And the understanding is that now that It's not just, of course, something that's nourishing for the physical body, but it's also there to stimulate consciousness and to give nourishment to the soul. And most important, it's recognition on the part of the parents that they want constantly to be able to protect their child in such a way that the blessings are always there. The blessings are always coming. Protect their child, realizing that, yes, we're in mature world, we're having to deal with so much maintenance, we're having to deal with maintaining the body and the soul together, but we want to keep our priorities, that our main concern, our main emphasis, is that we are spiritual entities, we're spiritual beings who happen to have a certain physical body, who happen to have a certain profession, who happen to be in a certain part of the world, who happen to be in a certain gender, who happen to be in a certain race, who happen to be of a certain age. These are all secondary considerations. And to help to remind us of that, when we enter into these changes, when we do things that will be spiritually uplifting, as a way to minimize the stagnation of one thinking that life is only a matter of just trying to enjoy the physical body. So I'll give you a slight update after we give the grains, and then we'll see what questions that you have. Today we'll just do a very simple ceremony. I'm kind of in between several things. We are just in the process now of finishing our next book, Spiritual Warrior, this second volume. And this book is, the title is Transforming Lust into Love. So the book is finished. We're doing some last editing with the idea, the whole set. And I guess in 2 months or so we can have it printed and available. I have several conferences to go to where we're discussing relationship issues in the grihastha or the house or ashram. So I'm hoping that we'll have it ready in time that I can be able to use it for that. And of course later we'll be doing several media things in relationship to that. Also, just coming, since I was here last time, a few weeks ago, I went to Canada. They had a major festival there, which went for a couple of days. And I literally spent half the time there. I didn't stay the whole time. I went to our project in West Virginia. Because in New Bandavan, we have 3,000 acres of land. And it's like a little, of course, it's developing into a spiritual village. We had some problems there, but now things are going quite strong again. So we're having a little conference, some of the leaders of the project itself, and some of a few of the international and national leaders, is looking at the present and ways how we can expedite the future to development of the community. I was happy to see one thing was different, which we had saw before in visiting. That I was visiting one family, had single-handedly, this one devotee and two new bhaktas or two new priests, he had single-handedly cultivated about 35 acres of organic vegetables. And the way that they were doing the farming, similar to how Sadhachari is trying to do farming in Gitanagri, but on a small scale, it's called bio-intensive farming, where a smaller area or acreage of land can produce so much more than normally when we get from that particular situation. So with 34, 35 acres of land, there's enough food to feed, you know, the entire community many times over, even though there was, you know, hundreds of devotees there, and also to be able to, you know, to sell. That was just one family, but to sell others who have different small farms. Well, of course, there's a community farm also. And we were having, staying there, then after we had our major meeting, then we had a town meeting, which was designed for all of those who are living on the properties and in the neighboring areas to come. We did it literally outside in front of the temple. And so everyone came, as well as the children, with the idea that we wanted devotees to hear some of the things that we had discussed about the present and about future plans, and to also address any questions, any issues they had, any concerns, any problems. And of course, that was quite nice. It's a very diversified group, and so lots and lots of heterogeneity or variegateness in the discussions. Then I went, of course, from there to Gitanagri. And so we're having our the yearly Ratiyatra festival, and hundreds of people came in from all over the East Coast. It's a one-day event. Next time we want to extend it longer. And of course, there was quite a spiritual carnival atmosphere. It was quite nice. And a unique feature this year, we had two plays. We had the children's performing the play, as well as the adults, and of course, entertainment that went up into the world, and lots of prasadam, spiritual refreshments, etc. Now, right after that, the natural next day, we had a four-day conference on rural development, on Varnashram Dharma, on establishing healthy rural development with a spiritual model or a spiritual cultural paradigm. So we had keynote speakers coming from so many different places, from France, from India, and from several of the rural projects that we have in America. And so actually we had pretty much 90% of the top devotees in the world who address the Hare Krishna movement, who address these issues, to be in attendance and to present papers and in some cases books that they have been writing on or working on. And some who've been in the field, it's like we had one devotee from Lou Taliban, from the Tennessee Project, who's been working with cows for about 22 years or so. And then we had several of our educators who were also there. And it was everyone thought it was quite astounding. We're just formulating now tapes. There's about 20 tapes came from the conference. And we'll be advertising them very soon in the ISKCON World Review and to other media so that they can be available for people who are interested in sustainability, simple living and high thinking, and who would like to involve themselves in such projects. As a matter of fact, the radio show I did just yesterday, 2 days ago, and I was speaking about some of these things. We have some people who are contacting us now who are interested in being a part of such activities. So we'll be trying to connect with them in the future, both from the secular world as well as from the spiritual communities. Also from the conference, we have some families who would like to come in to live with us. One family from Puerto Rico, who've also been involved in rural projects for many, many years. This is something we are very eager to have, you know, anyone, but especially people who have some skills in these areas, have some past background, because development, simplicity is not simple. It's quite difficult to live simply, because we have to recondition ourselves in so many ways. And there's a need for people who really have great love for the land, who have great love for the natural order of things, and are not just so distracted, by material things per se. And it's not quite so easy sometimes. We're so urbanized, we're in an environment that is more geared for spirituality, then often our minds become disturbed because we're so much wanting. We're like addicts, like junkies. So much used of so much mundane sound vibrations, and so many mundane foodstuffs, and so many mundane things to see and to look at, etc. So this is quite a wonderful challenge. We're trying to put together some master plans in how to be able to see with all haste. And then just this morning, I got I had the program last night, we got in. I had a chance to look at some of my messages on the internet. And so one nice message was coming from our devotees in South Africa. Same devotee who put on the big major Food for Life program, the actual organizer. Most of you know, some months ago we had a fantastic Food for Life program where we served about 65,000 free lunches to children in South Africa. And at that engagement, because the president was there and so many other dignitaries and international media, but many things are coming from that. One of the things coming from that is the next deputy president of South Africa. Nelson Mandela will be stepping down soon. He's president after president, probably become president, and then sort of like the third top person in the country now. He's very much interested in agricultural development, rural development. She's telling me I'm talking too long, I need to give her something. Okay, I'll stop in a minute, you darling. We've just, some of our people there just approached him a few days ago about the country arranging for about 1,000 or so acres of land to be given to us so that we can embark upon a rural city development project that will emphasize cottage industries. She's supposed to give me grain, but right now she'll take milk for a little while. So we're looking at first an arrangement to be given 1,000 acres of land from the government with the idea of doing a project, a model project for the country. And as many of you are hearing, our movement is very, very strong there, and we're making a major impact in the actual developments of the future of the new South Africa. So our devotees are being consulted. I had a chance to offer advice as consultants. And so one of the things I was doing early this morning is going over the facts and giving certain ideas of things that we could try to work on and things that we should put in our proposal when we meet with these leaders again next week. And so one thing I was emphasizing is a little different than what they expected. So I wanted to make it clear to our devotees that we should let the government know that we're not so much interested in going into the rural areas just to create the environment of the cities. We're not interested in just going into the rural areas and just emphasizing development of Kali Yugic or sinful technologies. That we're interested in sustainability, and that a major part, 50% of our own philosophy and movement is based on creating a simplistic life that's outside of urban settings, and that our founder, Acharya Siddhartha Prabhupada, so much wanted to see this happen all around the world. And so our interest would be to help the people to use basic local resources rather than abuse or exploit or misuse, to help them to be able to connect more with developing simplistic industries, cottage industries, that will be, of course, friendly to the environment and things that can take place within the environment, etc. So this will be a chance, as I said a couple of days ago, we're talking a lot about these sort of things and trying to see how to do it here in America, and it's quite difficult. But in one sense, not quite as difficult in countries where people are more adjusted to agrarian life. And so we feel that it'll be a lot easier in these places where we have people who are more trained working with oxen, more trained in doing simplistic farming, more trained in being able to build simple facilities. Like in part of the messages that I get this morning or last night, the director of the Food for Life program was mentioning how they have a technology that can be used where they can build many houses for what would be comparable to about $200. You can't even rent a room for that. You can barely rent a motel. You rent a motel for $200. And so they have some way that we can, just $200, be able to build many homes in some of these areas. So a lot of things can happen with a little bit of money, a little bit of input, etc. So we're looking forward to that. And especially because it gives us a chance to apply our philosophy. Anyone will get frustrated after a while. You're just thinking about religious, theological, and spiritual considerations without being able to see it happen, or without being able to be a part of the unfolding. That's why you'll see many people in different religious traditions. They're so frustrated. Because life is much more than just praying, meditating, chanting, toning. It's much more than worshiping from Sunday to Sunday, Saturday to Saturday, Friday to Friday. It's much more than just reading Bible, Quran, Torah, Vedas, etc. It's about using these things, reading these things. It's about exploring and then acting upon or arranging so one begins to experience what is in the particular books. The books should become like windows to the spiritual dimension. But in most cases, people are still so theoretical in their spiritual and philosophical pursuits that after a while, they begin to create racism based on religious considerations, sectarianism. In other words, they use religion for politics, or even for business, or just for another aspect of expanding their egos. Now you have people who are making a lot of money in the New Age movements, people who are so much into seeing themselves as the God that they're losing their sense of humanity, sense of compassion, their sense of devotion, while they are supposedly involving themselves in some devotional or spiritual culture, but not really. Because if it doesn't make, if it's just making the heart hard, then it's just rituals. If it's not helping the person to become more loving, then it is just conceptual. It's not helping the person to gain more realizations where they're literally being able to become less attracted to the mundane, then at best, it is just usually mechanical. But when it is genuinely a spiritual connection, then we will seriously see how one's consciousness changes, is changing in connection with their actions. There are many people who are professing to be spiritual, but in fact, they're hiding behind spirituality, or they're pimping spirituality, or they're using spirituality because it's becoming an end thing. Becoming an end thing to be a meditator. Becoming an end thing to have a guru. Becoming an end thing to travel to different places for sacred pilgrimage. Becoming an end thing to have different types of spiritual paraphernalia within one's home or one's facility, etc. But the question is, to what degree are we becoming spiritual? Or what degree are we using or hiding behind things that are spiritual? So, my schedule is quite a little bit uncertain. I'm staying in America a little longer this time than I normally do because of this interest in trying to get a better handle on some of the rural development projects. But also, we're trying to make more appeal, you know, to the media, that as we're writing these books and things, that we can use it as a way to piggyback making, you know, various types of connections. So we'll of course have questions, but maybe Drupadi, you can bring her.
Should I put her on a mat or something?
No, I'm just holding.
Okay, don't cry.
Don't cry. You gonna cry? Okay.
It's okay.
Why don't you go back to her in a little while? Oh, okay. I can't feed you if you don't want to cry. Where's her brother? Is her brother around?
She loves me. She's looking at the camera now.
Can I give you something? She says, we know he's not supposed to be holding women. He says, this is nice. So the idea is that this is some grains. First time she's had grains into the system. So she's taking it as it has been blessed. And now, of course, the mother will start feeding her, you know, some solid foods. Up to now, she's been only taking milk. It's a pretty healthy baby. Now she'll be taking grains. So is there some questions? any of you have, like you try to take some? Maybe I can, Scott, I can just use your, you know, the letter you gave me, because I think it's an interesting question, concern for all. Sometimes we notice that when we take to some higher aspects of spiritual life, there's some, it's often confusing. Most of us are from Christian backgrounds. Some people sometimes from Muslim backgrounds. We notice in the Judeo-Christian involvements, there is often a lot of kind of festive activities, the wonderful choirs, many anniversaries, often a lot of men's groups, women's groups, etc. And sometimes we will find that we will miss this, because Srila Prabhupada explained that religion without philosophy, Srila Prabhupada explained, is actually sentimentalism. And philosophy without religion is mental speculation. So sometimes we have religion, but it's not much philosophy. And so it's good sentiment, but it doesn't really raise consciousness. It's kind of entertaining. And sometimes we have philosophy, we don't have religion, and then it's hard to keep acting upon the philosophy. Because with philosophy, we need an environment that helps us to be able to know how to use it. We need an environment that is reinforcing, stimulating, that assists in allowing us, as we were talking about, rites of passages. We need an environment that helps us to move through situations in a healthy, holistic way. So sometimes when people come into movements like this or associate with our books or whatnot, sometimes they feel a little disturbed, because there's lots and lots of philosophy. I mean, there's no limit to, you know, to philosophy. But if they're not simultaneously feeling that the environment is helping them to live that, if they are coming from environments, of course, where there is a lot of bonding, a lot of stewardship, a lot of camaraderiness, then if they are not getting that, then after a while, one will no longer be enthused about the philosophy, even though it may be of something of a higher nature, but they will find themselves going back into their environments where there is some type of culture. So it's very, very important that as we access Krishna conscious philosophy, that we do not just hold on to philosophy without a social economic environment that helps us to be able to live that philosophy. One of the most important things, of course, is loving relationships. One of the most important things is excitement and adventure. Nobody, especially children, want to be a part of something that doesn't have some excitement, that doesn't have some enjoyment. We are all seeking enjoyment. So the question that spiritual life should not just be rules and regulations, but no longer any focus about enjoyment. No, sometimes people are thinking, okay, now I have to be some kind of dry renunciate and restrict myself from social exchanges, or restrict myself from relationships. No. Because ultimately the spiritual world is the environment of pure, ongoing relationships with variegatedness, etc. So it's kind of like someone who has been addicted to something, they're trying to get away from that addiction. And at one point, they may just really restrict themselves from the environment where it used to go on, from the people. And as they become more mature, it is not so much of avoiding, but it's a matter of, we say, paramistanavartate, of replacing a lower thing with the higher thing. Not just a matter of stopping. Huh? We say, oh, to be spiritual, you should stop this. Don't eat meat, fish, or eggs. No gambling, no intoxication, no illicit sex, no this thing, no this thing, no that thing. No, that is not the way to approach spiritual culture. The Prabhupada once explained it to us when we were, me, over 20 years ago, and we were doing lots of programs at universities all around America and other parts of the world. And he explained to us emphatically, he says, don't go into the universities explaining to people that this Vedic knowledge is just rules and regulations, but you explain how it is a higher philosophy, so that people will then understand and appreciate it based on the higher tenets that it offers. Otherwise, you just turn people off when you're telling them, well, you want to advance in spiritual life, then, you know, don't do this thing and don't do that thing. But this, you know, causes people to be somewhat repulsed, or they feel imposed upon. So, similarly, when we can understand that if we do certain things, it will help us in enjoying life more without negative consequences. It will help us to really to go beyond just the limitations of our present senses and be able to purify our senses and our minds. Then it becomes exciting. And given that we're always pleasure seekers, we are going for pleasure based on certain cultural or social schemes. And when we don't have those, then again, it's like somebody who's addicted, who's trying to stop the addiction, then they will just repress because the desires will be there. And after a while, they will go back to the same thing or another type of addiction. But if they can replace that addiction with knowledge, understanding, now with something higher, then there's not a problem. So we're really replacing the culture of degradation and of incarceration with the culture of liberation. But in every case, it's a culture. But if we don't feel the cultural connection, then we'll feel so much like that the experience of the of Krishna consciousness is mostly just an experience of philosophers who are hard-hearted or who speak something but are not able to put it into practical arrangements, or it doesn't really apply so much in the practical world. And so there will be a problem if that is the way people are thinking. This is one of the reasons that we have this kind of project, institute. It's a way to be able to grasp ancient wisdom, ancient knowledge, universal truths. It's a way to take Vedic philosophy and to apply it in our professions. We're to take Vedic philosophy and to make it more relevant in our day-to-day lives as we are using material things and not abusing them. Renunciation is not a matter of avoidance, but it's a matter of healthy consciousness, of being able not to claim proprietorship. And so if people see that spiritualists have some spiritual philosophy, but they're impractical, they're incompetent, they're insensitive, will not spread spiritual philosophy very far. As a matter of fact, if we look historically, any major world religion can only be spread in a big sense if there is Kshatriya power. That means if it is in connection with administration, governmental considerations, even though these things are contaminating. Christianity, Christians would still be thrown to the lions if it wasn't for Constantine becoming converted. As Constantine became converted, then massive things began to happen on a large scale. People began to accept. Same thing with Buddhism. Those who were following Buddhism were simply being harassed, simply being considered as cults, being seen as weird, lives are being threatened and everything. But once Ashoka took to Buddhism, then it became established like state religion, began to spread on a huge scale. And you'll see with Islam also, gets bigger and bigger spreads as powerful people in positions take to it, honor it, appreciate it, or at least stop interfering with it, and then it spreads. Now it's not that God or spirituality, it's not that Krishna is limited to being the servant of leaders, etc. But in any situation, whatever leaders do, it affects the masses of people. Whatever leaders do, it either stagnates and exploits and manipulates the people, or it creates environments and situations that allows their greater interest or care to be to be addressed. So, in such regard then, that One is just taking spiritual life as some kind of cloistered thing and not being somehow able to live it, to share it, so that it affects cultural patterns or is relevant to cultural patterns, then it will remain as a philosophy rather than as a lifestyle, etc. So we may miss at first some of those experiences that we had in camaraderieship, like in fraternities, or like with just certain friends who we used to move with and engage in sense gratification. And then we come to devotional service and we find that some of those same friends who we used to move with when we were doing simple things no longer feel comfortable with us or ourselves with them. Now that will need a void, because now there are things that you were doing with people, you're not doing it with them, unless now you are able to have some strong bonds and with spiritual associates, one will feel rather depressed and bereft. It's always like a pyramid. The more you become spiritual, then the less and less people are you able kind of to identify with this addiction. Because more and more people are the bottom levels of the pyramid, and they're just docile. They're just accepting whatever is there based on sense gratification. So as you start moving more and more in the plane of conscious development, then you'll find that you're thinking differently, you're acting differently. And there's not so many people who you're able to really to bond with in such serious ways. But bonding must be there. Therefore, one should seek out people of similar consciousness, of higher consciousness, to associate with. And there must be deep relationships in that connection, otherwise there'll be a serious emptiness. There are many people who start off on a spiritual path who then, you know, backslide and become hypocrites, because they just don't seem to be able to grasp hold, you know, to a niche. But they're not able to grasp hold to an environment they feel is sufficiently supportive. And after a while, they'll get weak, then they'll start justifying all types of deviations. They just go back into, you know, past patterns. So we shouldn't find it unusual that that may be there first, because we like changing from one space to another space. We're trying to remove from just those things that are good temporary satisfaction and stimulation, which may come kind of easy at first, and then they give pain and there's some suffering and consequences. But the most sinful things, at first, they're enticing and they're stimulating. But then later, there's consequences to react upon. And most things that are beneficial, you have to pay some price for it. You have to struggle. You have to endeavor. Then after we have endeavored and we've established ourselves, then there's many, many benefits. Like sometimes just an investment, or business in general. At first, you know, it takes a lot to invest, but then once you've established, then you're able to receive the benefits from that investment. But now keep in mind, we're mostly geared in society to get the quick fix. We want the quick stimulation, the quick satisfaction. So it becomes very hard for most people to be spiritual, in a deep sense, because they're used to the quick fix. They want something to happen right away. And when it doesn't happen right away, then they're ready to jump to something else. Keep jumping, without a chance to have that perseverance that allows sufficient healthy growth. So we have to realize how dangerous it is by just being in the bombarded, you see, by modernity, where everything now is being given to us real fast, but in a very superficial way. We want to kind of step back from that a little bit and try to see what is beyond the facades, what is beyond the superficial, and try to grasp that that is, you know, that is more eternal, that which is anathema, in that sense. So it is a serious point that if we're moving from one space to another space, then there must be a healthy replacement. And if not, then there will be, you know, some lacking, in that sense. So any questions anyone has?
This question is, why is a spiritual master necessary? If I have a relationship with God, why is a spiritual master necessary if I have a relationship with God?
Just like there is a certain aspect of psychology that suggests that everybody can do almost anything. Someone can become a great, you know, composer, a great artist, a great poet. Potential is there. But why someone is becoming more of that or becoming that and someone isn't. We all have different propensities, that's there. But also, the soul is full of knowledge, full of bliss, understanding, etc. But based on environmental situations, heredity and environment, then we see certain things begin to become accessed. And particularly based on role models and based on mentorship. Someone becomes a very powerful architect because they have some interest, but also because they are reading from and they are studying from those who are excellent or high achievers. Someone becomes a good sportsman because they are reading or they are hearing about, but most important, because they have chance to associate with others who are expert in the area. So in almost any area, aspect of life, it becomes important about, again, theoretical or philosophical knowledge and application, being able to associate with those who have some sense of mastery. Even more important is when something is very significant, something is very profound, becomes even more important to have some models, some guidance. But that consciousness is to be stimulated through association. Intelligent person never tries to do everything themselves. That's a foolish person. A person who is just passionate, energetic, but actually displacing a lot of energy. But intelligence is to know where to go, who to go to, what to use, what is proper and what is improper. It's being selective in such sense. So someone who is spiritually intelligent or is spiritually hungry and astute, then they will be selective about trying to get guidance in their getting of guidance. But always they will know that there's a need for guidance, a need for prophetship, a need for mentorship. This is a matter of them wanting it and knowing what constitutes quality mentorship, and then being genuine and being able to follow it once they have a connection. It's like there was a magazine I get when I was, I guess, in West Virginia. And it was just, I think it was a U.S. News report or something. But there were several pages where they were categorizing, qualifying hospitals all around the country. So they had a whole list based on what your ailment is, what hospitals are best in those areas. And so there were certain hospitals that were kind of pretty good across the board almost. Some hospitals may be better, you know, with cardiac problems, some other hospitals this problem, that problem. And so the reason that one hospital can be considered better based on their qualifications and based on their criterion was that they have more experts who have a greater sense of excellence in their performance. Almost the opposite. Those hospitals that got very low ratings, they had, you know, people less trained or people who were trained but weren't able to carry it out properly. They had more, you know, malpractices. They had, you know, less people being able to really to be fully helped based on what was going on. And so there was some difference. So sometimes one may be very scrutinizing, they have a serious ailment, then they want to find out, where can I go that's more likely that I can get good care based on this ailment and on this particular problem. So the intelligence is not that they try to take care of themselves necessarily, but that they use their intelligence to decipher where to go to get the best kind of help that they need for their particular sickness. So a person who is spiritually intelligent will in no way try to just reinvent the wheel, or just trying to dabble, speculate, and experiment and think that, well, because God is available, they're going to somehow, you can see miraculously, become God conscious. It's the most difficult thing to do. But they will intelligently try to seek guidance. And so that guidance means need for guru, need for his mentorship, the need for guidance, the need for, you know, spiritual, for a spiritual director. Other questions?
This question is, how did Narada Muni...
These are questions that some of the audience have written down?
Yes.
Okay. No, I don't know who it is, doesn't matter. Yes, okay.
Oh, yeah, sure. Someone in what it sure. is. How did Narada Muni achieve perfection and liberation considering this,
It kind of goes on with this last question we just asked, The power of those who are carriers, you know, of high level of divinity. So, Narada Muni, his mother was a maidservant, or like a house girl, we say in India or Africa, and who took very good care, you know, of visitors. And so very saintly visitors were coming to visit the home. And Narada Muni, being a small child, was assisting the mother, but also sometimes taking some spiritual food or remnants, you know, prasadam. Less food is if we gave the baby some less grains. So the by taking some less foodstuffs, then karma was affected, consciousness was affected. And by that, then so many auspicious things began to take place for him, began to unfold by the association of the Mahabhagavatas. See, everyone is carrying, within this physical body we're moving around, is carrying so much based on their desires and aspirations. They're bringing so much based on our previous lives, and so much is going to unfold for our future. So, a very high level souls, their love for the Supreme spills over. Just like with a contagious disease. You're around someone, contagious disease, and you can get infected by that disease because they're curious of it. They're infected. They're carrying the germs. In certain contexts, you will get infected by that germ. You will also become a carrier of that germ. So high-level spiritualists, they are a carrier of the bhakti. They're carriers of the devotion. And so by being around them, by listening to them, associating with them, doing service for them, then some of that spills over, blessings spill over. And a major, major part of our spiritual growth comes from grace, that comes from blessings. See, our ability to really break out of the mold is very, very difficult. Doesn't matter how expert you perform yajnas, how expert you perform rituals, how expert you do anything. Because especially in this age, even our greatest level of expertise is still so limited and mature and mundane. And so much happens as we put forth the effort. But the connection of blessings, of grace, must be there for that to really sufficiently fructify. The Lord sees our effort, then He also arranges for us to be able to get blessings or to be able to get association that can help us. But no one can break out of the three modes of material nature fully out of sense gratification just based on their own ideas, their own realizations, their own manipulations, or just based on their own appreciation of, you see, philosophy. But it takes, as we said, it takes spiritual culture, and culture always has to do with mentorship. Whenever there's culture, genuine culture, there is community, there is elders, there is priests, there's guidance. If there's a culture without those who guide, there's no culture. If there's culture without some standard, there's always some criterion, some standards, some way to evaluate excellence. And those who are some carriers of that excellence, and it's passed down. So you see the opposite of what we're normally experiencing now, which kind of, you know, you see often children treating their parents only as almost as if they are the same age. We see people being so disrespectful, you know, toward elders. Even just a few years ago, I mean, 10, 15 years ago, you would find that in many places, children would be very reluctant, just cursing around elderly people or fighting with elderly people, etc. But now it's almost the opposite. You find so many kids, they don't care who is, you know, whether in the bus or the plane or the train or in public places, They will be just as aggressive and just as ridiculous as they would if no elders were around, And even sometimes they'll get angry at the elders. And they'll even be abusive or exploitive, rather than, you know, being protective and being concerned. But when there's culture, first you try to avoid doing things wrong. If you are doing something wrong, when you see those who are carriers of the culture, immediately you kind of, you see, regroup. But now, because people have been so disheartened and disappointed, you know, almost the opposite is true.
It's interesting you're talking about family. I have so many friends of mine who are really, you know, what you would call pious people, very loving, you know, very community-minded, trying to contribute to the community, and very much in, you know, seemingly in the mode of business, and they have children. And their children, especially once they become teenagers, just, I mean, go completely crazy and do all kinds of, you know, really demonic and ignorant things. And these are people that create, you know, environments in their home that are very supportive and loving and so forth and so on. Yet it seems to be insufficient to, you know, to really capture the children.
It's definitely insufficient. Because what is that child mostly hearing and seeing? The child is mostly hearing and seeing first television. 6-8 hours a day, the average American is watching television. The child is spending so many hours in school. What are they hearing and seeing? The child is spending so many hours in the neighborhood with other children, other families. That little small time that they're getting exposure with their parents is very minute. It's there as a seed. But that seed will not be properly fructified unless, again, there is culture, there is an environment that also helps to water that seed. Otherwise, you find almost the opposite. The parents are trying to be protective and trying to give some good examples. And the kid even rebels even more because they feel imposed upon. They're wondering why my mother and father are so restrictive this way, that way, and my neighbors are like this, my other friends are like this. And instead of appreciating, they take the opposite. They get angry. They get disturbed. And they respond by becoming sometimes even more sinful or more ridiculous or more rebellious than even those families that don't have, you know, so much of a culture. So it's very important that, you know, you constantly, again, 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 take the village, you know, to raise a child. It's a very serious undertaking. It takes a village to maintain a healthy adult also. Because we fall prey to temptation so easy. So we need to have more, you know, more support in that sense by the kind of circles, you know, that we're associating. Any other questions?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could explain your thoughts on examples.
Mm-hmm. So, historically speaking, there's always been different changes, geological changes on the planet. And there's always, as we mentioned yesterday, some rise and falls of civilizations, rise and fall of cultures. And sometimes it's happening on very grand scales where there is tremendous shifts, you know, geological, planetary shifting that takes place. So just as there are many, many predictions from a geological, from a economic, sociological, and psychic basis, that we should be expecting some major shifts to take place in our own museum lifetimes. So there are reports that there are times when some major shift took place, when there was some different levels of higher knowledge that was existing, when civilization was at a certain level, and then all of a sudden, abruptly, you see that civilization changes. And so the times of the falling of Atlantis and Mu are purported at certain times in world history when there was a major changes that took place in civilization, where major numbers of people on the planet actually somehow just died or disappeared overnight. And so scientists have seen this as they examine from archaeological and biological perspectives. So they're seeing that they're finding some dinosaurs who, when they, and there are cases where the bodies have been frozen for so many years. But now they find that in their stomachs they have been eating tropical, things. and the particular region they found them in, nutsets did not exist. So they realized that when that animal died, it was a total different environment. And the proof of it shows and what the animal was eating. And they're wondering, so how did the world change so fast? And understanding the change is taking place because there was a major, you know, global shift in the with the planet. The Earth is a physical being, physical entity. It's going through different stages, different thresholds, different cleansing effects, etc. And so, just as we see certain species that kind of disappear overnight, or different cultural patterns that just change overnight, I mean, something abrupt happened for those things to take place. Therefore, we are expecting certain abrupt things to happen in the near future. That's one of the reasons we're also trying to emphasize the people to embrace simplicity, to embrace or become more aware of alternative energies, become more aware of living or rural type of lifestyles. Because when next changes take place, and it's a breakdown of most of what we now consider to be modernity, then people will be able to survive as they're able to live a life of simplicity, where they can live off the land again. They can literally be able to be, you know, to be more natural. Because a spiritual culture, in a deep sense, can never be so strong when people have made so many idols of material, you know, sense gratification of things. Because that replaces their deep love, replaces their ability to experience, you know, more of God's love. So many things in our life, they can distract us from simplicity, especially if we claim ownership. And we're not saying that being poor is being spiritual. No. That's not the case. Because spirituality is a rich condition, rich in terms of realization and understanding. But when we become slaves to material things, then that, of course, is a problem. One can be very spiritual and have all kinds of assets, money, facilities, etc., etc. But to the degree that we have become slaves and they are controlling us rather than using those things to glorify the Lord, then it becomes a stagnation. Any last questions? Sometimes we're thinking that it's something very, very wonderful just to renounce. Nothing so wonderful just to avoid things. But it's wonderful to be able to access positive things. So sometimes in the process, there's certain things we definitely refrain from. We move out of our life space. But most significantly, it's how we can maintain our spiritual consciousness in any environment. How we can access that to be able to serve the Lord. Now, of course, very sinful environments is definitely going to be more difficult. So we want to minimize the difficulties. But one, again, should not be the type of person who can only be spiritual when they are in a spiritual facility. Because the real test is after you leave. The real test is after you finish your chanting, after you finish your reading, then what do you do after that? The real test is after you finish your meditation, what do you do after that? How now you've integrated that into your life. You're able to share it and you're able to live it. Sometimes people go through all kinds of austerities, and as soon as they have to deal in difficult environments, they completely lose it. It means it's not a serious integral part of their consciousness. They can only be spiritual when they're with people of their same group, same religion, same age group, same race, same gender. They can only be spiritual if they are reading from their particular religious text. But again, that's just theoretical. Question is, yes. So gatherings are important. They help to stimulate, remind us. But now, once you leave those places, how much do we imbibe in our lives, radiate what we have been hearing, what we have been living, what we have been reading, etc. That's why we're saying sometimes now, there's so much religion without philosophy. People go to religious gatherings, And there's like a performance, like an entertainment, huh? Someone is speaking, kind of entertaining, then you go back, and that's over. But the question is, now you heard something, how much has it helped you, or encouraged you, to enthusiastically to try to become more spiritual? We hear a spiritual person speaking, and it hasn't really enthused us to try to become more spiritual. It means the speaker is important, or we are much more in difficulty than we think. That we don't have real serious desire to make a change. Whenever you go to any spiritual gathering, you should leave with a sense of wanting to commit yourself more. To leave with a sense of wanting to do your part more. To leave with a sense of taking a closer look at your own life to see whether there may be some weaknesses, so you can work on those, if there's some strengths, to reinforce those. We go to spiritual gatherings to hear about somebody else's realizations. We go to spiritual gatherings to hear about somebody speaking allegorically about, you know, religious scriptures. And we don't feel some push within our own consciousness to try to improve our standards. Either the speaker was important, or we are not very serious about spiritual growth ourselves. And we want to hear from someone who's just going to kind of pat us on the back and help us to feel okay as we are deviant.
Is that what you mean by empowerment?
Yes, empowerment is one to, you know, feel personally involved, personally committed, to feel that their contribution makes a difference. Not just feel a number, or not just hide behind an institution, or hide behind a religion. There are a lot of people who hide behind religions, hide behind institutions, hide behind organizations, and don't really sufficiently work on themselves. And then you also get disappointed with organizations and institutions, because they've taken the institution and organization as the thing of itself. It's a means. Any religion is a vehicle, it's a means, not a thing in itself. The thing is development of consciousness. The thing is becoming free of sense gratification. The thing is recognizing one's, reclaiming one's original heritage. Not just a matter of what you dress, what dress you wear, what songs you sing, what kind of facilities you worship in. It's all in the background. It's rather superficial.
I have some summer students on my job, a 17-year-old, an 18-year-old, and a 26-year-old. And I see them kind of, because they've been educated, you know, the same kind of similar way I was, actually a better education, but they're kind of going down the same path that I went down, and which I would really like them to kind of not go down that path, you know. I guess my question is, how can I, you know, kind of guide them? We've had a couple of conversations, like they don't believe in God, but we've had a conversation about God kind of being in control and being the controller and actually being a person, because one of my students, his father was in the military and he was in a couple of wars, and he noticed that people died no matter whether they were good or bad. And so we got into a discussion that, you know, that there's a plan, and that, you know, that God has a plan, God has an arrangement, because he said that actually that really helped his father to see that there was a divine being. So I guess my question is, how can I, they're very interested in music, and they're very interested in science, but they're not really interested in spirituality.
They may not be interested in religiosity. They probably haven't understood what spirituality is. So in every exchange, if there is communication, or there is some common, you know, ground, and there can be some serious appreciation. We just try to preach to people or preach at people. We can have something valuable, but if there's no serious communication, it won't make much sense. So they're interested in science, and you can try to explain certain philosophical principles based on the scientific basis. And then there are rational or irrational minds to be able to understand, and then there will be some receptivity trying to hear more. So there, you see biologists also?
Yes. One of them is interested in sharks, and Leela told me that in the sea, you know, Krishna is a shark, because I said, oh, she's interested in sharks, and, you know, she's very, very interested in sharks. So I told her that, but, you know, God takes, you know, many forms. And
now you can try to explain to them some things about the nature of the soul. You can also explain to them some things about the nature of physics, the nature of matter itself. Because they're understanding now in the new physics that behind the gross matter, there is subtle matter. Behind the neutrons, the protons, the electrons, there is like what they consider spirit energy. You see that there's something that's what's called antimatter, it's actually spirit. So where is that spiritual situation coming from? Mm-hmm. Something greater, they recognize it's something greater than just, you know, gross, obviously, matter. And that as we understand how the process of reciprocity, a reaction produces a corresponding reaction, that the reactions are not always immediate. So sometimes the actions of karma, it comes at a later time. So it takes a later time, it unfolds based on what has been set into motion. And so sometimes we experience reactions in this immediate life, sometimes later in this life, of course, and sometimes in the next life also. And there's so much research out now about near-death experiences, about, you know, life after death, things that can help people at least to realize there's more than what they are thinking is a reality. Once they're able to open up to that there's more, they begin to wonder, to know more about the systems that additional stuff is based on.
It's interesting because these children grew up with Star Wars, so they accept a lot of things that I find, you know, like UFOs, that I find to be a stretch. On the one hand, they accept that.
Yes.
On the other hand, they're also very materialistic in their what they want to do, what they want to be.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes they, such children or young adults, will be sensitive because it's at a time now where so many things are coming out, the media, entertainment, but it's coming out also in a way of entertainment on a mood of not sort of, again, one working on him or herself, but just pondering upon it or trying to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
You see? Not that Star Wars is helping them to kind of become more philosophical about the nature of things, recognizing that something like that is weird, that exists, it's pretty far out, they can enjoy, you know, and they want to turn it on and turn it off, and boom, that's it. See, the demons are using some of these things also. Sometimes when they see that people are gradually making progress, they find ways just to capitalize off that, then to bring them to a wrong conclusion. You see, so many people are interested in psychic and metaphysical things. So they're having so many shows now that also are just, you know, exploiting, you know, these kind of things. Some people are interested in extraterrestrials. And they're having so many, you know, also weird types of things to make people feel that it's just a figment of people's imagination, or it's just a matter of, you know, kind of kooky people who explore these sort of things, or just something that you get entertainment from. One way is just to kind of keep things away from people so they don't become aware at all. In other words, you see, you can't just stagnate. If you can't repress, then you let some things out and you just distort it.
Mm-hmm.
So it brings confusion.
That's a very good point, because one of the things I try to do is look at those kinds of things with my son,
mm-hmm.
and to tell him, you know, they had a program on Friday night, Millennium, I don't know, and they dealt with May 5th, 2000.
Should have called us.
Sorry. And it was distorted, you know, and
yeah.
I had to tell him, well, you know, they try to make it look like the man is crazy. He's talking about May 5th, 2000. And I said, but that's not crazy, but a lot of people will accept it that way because they see this on television.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, and those of you who are parents, and I mean, it's just imperative that we sit down and look at some of this stuff, you know, with our children and explain and interpret it for them. I said, oh, yeah, okay, I know. You know, but I just
want
to make sure you know.
Well, it's important. If we just try to refrain sometimes from our kids getting exposed to things, you're not going to get exposed to it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So many things. It's a matter of the parents being able to kind of treat the kid in a very intelligent mood and help them to understand and to appreciate. You tell a kid, no, 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 no. When they get a chance, they're just going to go, yes, 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 yes. So they have to see, they'll be more curious. I wonder why I'm not supposed to do this thing. You tell them, no. You find out. You know. Or worse, is that you tell your kid, you know, your parent is smoking, your parent is drinking, your parent is even sometimes taking drugs. They're telling the kid, you know, don't do this. But the message that they're sending to the child is, you can't do this while you're still immature and you're young. But when you're older, then you can do this. When you're a more mature person, you can do it. So the kid wants to be mature, right? The kid takes it with the idea of thinking, well, I think I'm mature already. I want experience what's based on maturity. So the parent is saying, don't do it. They see your adults doing it. And they're thinking, it's just not the right time to do it. They want to, you know, jump things and just experience now based on the fact that everybody's doing it. Well, if we are just too harsh on them, or too, well, not harsh, but too imposing, then we take the fun out of life for them. And they will agree for a while. But they'll be very intimidated. You know, children want, the other day, it was actually a year ago, I was trying to meet with some of the people in the outside communities from where our farm project is in Gidanagi. So there's a lot of families in all this, you know, peripheral areas. So we're trying to invite some of them to come to some of our programs. And then, some did, most didn't. But then we thought, one way to reach the parents, and also help the children, is to have some program and invite the children. So we had a program only for the children in the outside area. And then one of the teachers was saying, so, don't you give them a lecture? And he said, no, these kids don't want to hear a lecture. They want fun. So I contacted one of our devotees, actually it was Ms. Krishnanandini in Cleveland, who is a Gurukula, she does homeschooling, she's teach. And so I asked, I said, so I want some spiritual games. I want you to give me some spiritual games that have some serious philosophical import, but we want to be able to share some games with the children so that they can enjoy the experience of learning. She gave me about four or five different really interesting games. So I went in with the kids, they were all different ages, and we had fun. But at the same time, they learned a lot because it was an enjoyable experience. You know, little competition in some of them, some of the games, but it was very enjoyable. And after that, we had ice cream and pizza and popcorn.
All your favorites.
All my favorites. So you can bite me up anytime. But in that way, it was very healthy. And of course, the kids went back and talked to their parents. And of course, it was a good experience. You know? So it wasn't like an imposition for the children or for the parents in that sense. And so often in our teaching, we have to be sensitive to that. Just look at our own lives. We don't want to be in an environment where somebody's just forcing you to learn something. You're bored, you're unenthused. You'll just be waiting for a chance to run away from that environment. So if we're trying to force our kids, you know, to be ethical, to be moral, to be saintly, they just see it as a down, as a drag. You know, it'll be the opposite. So maybe your last question, and we'll stop. It's getting a little late.
Thank you so much, Shabbat. Did I understand you to say that for a religion or a philosophy to spread, it needs to be accepted by administrative?
Yeah, I said that it needs to charge your power. In other words, for a philosophy, religion, to be spread on a world scale, on a big scale, where masses, a majority of people begin to take to it, it has to be able to affect important players. Because the tendency in society is that leaders, they either facilitate something or they also can interfere and they can check. And so therefore, as we doing different things and trying to support or help the masses, there must also be some arrangement dealing with the classes in the sense of people who stagnate for the masses to be able to express their natural, you know, human and spiritual tendencies. It's like in war, well, you have to know your alliances, you have to know the adversary, you have to know the target, and you have to attack the target in different ways. As you attack the target, as you know, are able to protect yourself and attack the target, then there can be a great sense of victory. So if we're trying to go to the masses, but then they are not able to express their spirituality because of so many of the policies, of the laws, so many of the things that are imposed upon them, you know, it would not be so healthy. If you just try to affect only the leaders, and there's not people not understanding, it still doesn't, you know, have an effect. But constantly, time and time again, doesn't matter what environment it is, what the leaders do creates fads, it creates models, it enthuses people to act in certain ways. The world is so sinful now, in so many ways, because leadership is so sinful. And therefore people begin to follow, you know, suit. They begin to emulate also, you know, sinful personalities. So there's a need then to create revolution. A revolution is affecting people in all different capacities. Especially, you know, you can see the nucleuses. War, if you can hit sensitive targets, you can affect the generals, and you can really affect the soldiers. Now, it shouldn't be that one should think that, you know, it has to depend on just influencing these other people. But it has to be definitely a serious part of the package, especially if you're talking about a massive global mind shift. When you see massive global mind shift, you see people who are very powerful players who make that shift and influence others. You got so many people accepting Darwinism because you have such a powerful person and powerful position who spoke such nonsense. You got so many people, you know, accepting communism because you had some powerful people in powerful positions teaching that stuff, writing such books, and literally setting up governments and forcing people to have to live, you know, in such ways. This is why I explained about how Christianity really began to spread, Buddhism, Islam, many, many other teachings. When there is genuine oneness, then, and there's compassion, then obviously one is trying to share and to trying to help, you know, all types of people. And so then the philosophy began to spread. The mystical aspect is that the Lord in the heart will see the sincere priest or preacher and then will arrange the external energies in such a way that the message can come through. For instance, if someone is just trying to reach the rich and the famous or the powerful, they'll simply become unprincipled sinner. But if they are trying to share a message and they want to expand it more, then the Lord in the heart will arrange facility or agents who will help them to deal more with the mature energy so that the spiritual situation will become mercy prevailed. We see an example of Goswami, how Osanati Goswami, how they were just humble mendicants, humble saints. But because they were humble, they were serious, and they were equal poised, helping everybody, whether it's the ruffians or whether it's the royal class, then big business people, politicians, etc., step forward and they want to offer their services, offer their facilities. They become affected in consciousness, and therefore they become instruments to help the people in general.
So what I'm getting or just got from that is that we who are learning the philosophy and ought to preach it or teach it or share it should preach to where we are with it, but desire strongly in the heart for it to be spread further. And then you said Krishna will bring the facility and those.
Always. In other words, if we use what we have, or if we start with ourselves, or if we take whatever environment we're in as the most important for us, then as we work in that consciousness, then the organic things will naturally happen. We're always kind of pie in the sky, we're not doing sufficiently what we can do in our environment. Then it won't unfold. But as we are trying harder and harder to glorify the Lord based on whatever limited facility, limited manpower, limited money, limited realizations, then the next step step is always going to be more chance to do more, to do more, to do more. But main emphasis is that spiritual people should never think small. Even though they're in the, you know, in the minority, you know, there's this pyramid effect, they should never think small. Their love should be so strong for wanting to help make a conscious shift on the planet. Their love should be so strong in seeing the suffering that's going on. Their love should be so strong in seeing the pain that's there when people are constantly just jumping from one thing to the next, not knowing what life is about, not understanding about reincarnation, about karma, not understanding, you know, appreciating why we're in the physical body, in the physical world in the first place. Then someone who has sufficient compassion, they'll really want to do things, especially with their own lives, that it can make a difference. And by that, they will get help. And even great sense of empowerment. When a conditioned soul gets empowered in spiritual life, it's a sign that their desires to serve is stronger than their capacity. And because their desires are stronger than the facility or the capacity, then they are given blessings to be able to do things beyond the facility, beyond the capacity. When there is a real sense of spirituality, there's always the miracle happening. That is, the expressions that are going on beyond the capacity. We're trying to kind of alluding to that yesterday, or I think a couple of days ago, when we were having this ghost in Gitanagri. We were just telling the devotees, don't be in the mood of waiting for something to happen or waiting for somebody else to do. Don't be in the mood of waiting for an organization, for a group of individuals, for some other people to make something happen. Because people who really make things happen are not those who wait. They'll always be waiting. Even when the opportunity is there, they still won't act upon it. They'll always be finding reasons not to do something. There's always a whole lot of reasons. Somebody else isn't doing, there's not enough money, there's not enough facility, what the other person is going to think, and you'll never act upon that. One must feel that God has no favors. Everyone has a chance to become realized soul. Everyone has a chance to be able to be used, to be empowered. And one is thinking, well, why not me? I'm going to go for it. Act in that spirit, that we have our duty and responsibility to be able to do something as a way of expressing our love. And then when you have a lot of people thinking like that, there's something very, very powerful. But even a few people thinking that way is very powerful. Mm-hmm.
I just want to ask you something about the land in Gitanagri. Are you encouraging us now to go ahead and buy the land if we can make some arrangement to do that? I was wondering, are we still waiting for a package? Or are we just being encouraged to just...
Yeah, we're encouraging to buy because we, from a material perspective, we have a lot of information that the land price is going to go up much higher. And also we're trying to see that more and more spiritual-oriented people come into the environment. So we create this spiritual force field, this ability to be able to share, to exchange, and to protect. And so we are asking that those who have need to try to look upon such. And so in such a way that others who don't have the finances will be able then to also get some land given or a really a nominal fee made available to those who don't have the means.
Because my husband came home with the idea that we should buy this house in Hyatt, which I was like really flabbergasted because we can't afford it. But I was like, well, what about the land? You know, we don't have money for the land up there, but I can see that we could get that. I mean, that could be a goal. But
sure,
another
investment.
House.
You know, land is always a very powerful investment because even when money doesn't mean anything, land still does. And when other things are not there, you know, there's always a need for food or for a place to live. And so even if somebody was just considering, let me buy a couple of acres of land and, you know, I'll build later, or I'll put a trailer on, or I'll hold it and make it available to someone else, then it's still an investment, and you know, at least get that money back in many times over. Because, you know, there's some in the neighboring cities, we've seen all the prices of everything has gone up high. And we're just getting all the information that these areas, Port Royal is going to have the same thing. Yeah, I guess. You know, some of the ways of looking at, you know, trying to get a couple acres of land and just buying it and just holding it, you know, when they have a chance to be able to do something with it. And we're finding, you know, some of the builders we're contacting, we're finding that they can build some nice homes for just $40,000 or $50,000. You know, which is, you know, because in Washington you can't do much with $50,000 for building a home. But in some of these areas you can build two, you know, 2-3 room home for just, you know, $50,000 or so.